You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Alyssa Westring. Alyssa is Associate Professor of Management at the Driehaus College of Business, DePaul University, right here in Chicago. In addition, she is Director of Research at Total Leadership. An award-winning educator, Professor Westring shares her expertise on work-life integration, I like that better than balance, and women's careers in leading academic and popular outlets, and is a frequent speaker at Fortune 500 companies. She has a new book that she has co-authored with Stuart Friedman. It's called Parents Who Lead, The Leadership Approach You Need to Parent with Purpose, Fuel Your Career, and Create a Richer Life. Alyssa Westring, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I want to start the conversation at the end of your book.
Okay.
I am totally on board with the ideas you present, and I've read a bunch of the research myself on leadership, collaboration, creativity. But as I was winding through the last few chapters, I did find myself thinking, sort of in the back of my head, that these lessons, as important as they are simply not accessible to certain people based on their lack of privilege. And then I get to your postscript at the end of the book, and you write, quote, "There are cultural and structural barriers that make it difficult for parents to be meaningfully engaged in their careers and their family lives, particularly in the United States," end quote. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that fact. Most people don't, and I applaud you for doing it.
Oh, thank you. I started to get nervous when you said that. And I was like, uh-oh.
Where is he going?
Yeah, no, we know that the audience for our book are people who have a certain amount of freedom in their lives to make conscious choices. But when you're working two jobs, you have no paid parental leave, you have no health care, you know, the stuff in this book is not going to cut it,
right?
There needs to be national change, there needs to be organizational changes. So, yeah, we're fully aware, and we can only do so much in one book.
Yeah, and it's a both things are true, right? The it's not that the evidence isn't there for these things that can work, but you know they work only in a certain kind of context. And I think it's interesting too because what you're talking about, and I noted this in your bio that you talk about work-life integration because I mean like that term work-life balance just doesn't cut it anymore. And this book is very much about this sense of creating harmony or integration, you know, among all aspects of our lives.
Absolutely. It's not just work and parenting as the only two roles that we have. Certainly we're thinking about how do you engage with your community, the things that are important to you, your spirituality, your hobbies, your self-care, your sleep, your exercise, all of those are part of this equation.
And you also say, quote, "Revealing a full picture of our lives sometimes means getting honest about the darker side of parenting, like guilt, fear, or the disappointing fact that sometimes parenting isn't quite the fulfilling endeavor we were told it should be." That's some truth.
Yeah. It's tough. Parenting is hard. I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. So I've been writing this book for half their lives, at wow. least for my younger one. So, you know, we'd be writing a chapter and then I'd be struggling with the exact same principles in my own life and saying, oh, I just had this talk with my kids. It didn't go the way I thought it would. Or, you know, why even though I'm doing everything, you know, quote unquote, right, am I still feeling frustrated?
Yeah, you're talking to the guy who wrote the book Yes and then would say no to his kids and they'd be like,
oh, boy, yeah,
yeah. Right. Hey, where's my yes and? And I'm like, all right.
Exactly.
And I gotta be honest. Often they weren't wrong. Often it was a moment of like, oh, that is so easy, even with the knowledge base that I've got, to just slip into the no, when really, you know, in my case, the ideas are in yes and, or simply allowing for some alternatives to surface early in a conversation. And that is a good lesson to give your kids. And we do sort of, I think, sometimes automatically fall into the easy trope of no.
Right. And, it, you know, along a similar line, what we found in the book is that a lot of our readers are pretty enlightened leaders at work. Mm-hmm. They understand how to inspire people, how to have a vision, how to be these sort of creative leaders, the kind of bosses that we want to work for. And then they get home and they act like these obnoxious micromanagers that they would never want to work for, right? They're mm-hmm. just, are you doing it? Are you doing it the way I wanted? Why aren't you doing it right fast enough? So this idea of like knowing a principle in one part of your life and then taking it and kind of forgetting about it in another part is something that we're pretty familiar with ourselves.
And in the chapter that's titled Working as a Team, and at Second City we use the term ensemble to kind of get mm-hmm. across the same stuff you're talking about. You write, quote, avoid making assumptions about what your partner really means, wants, or needs. And I've seen the evidence on this. It's because we do that, right? And we're often wrong.
Yeah. And it's kind of people. So in the writing of the book, we worked with about 30 dual career couples with children. And we actually made them go through the exercise. Well, they volunteered, go through the exercises that are now what you see in the book. But they were our guinea pigs. And they would have these conversations. Here's what I think you expect of me. Here's what I expect of you. And, you know, sometimes they were really surprised that this person they've been living with for 20 years actually saw things quite differently than they expected.
Yeah. You know, Second City is in many ways an amazing focus group for this stuff, because we've mm-hmm. had those sketches in the past, those improvised sketches where we have couples come up and we ask questions about each of them, and they never know. I mean, it makes for great comedy, but, you know, great comedy is often getting at truth. And I think
right.
that we don't realize the level of autopilot that we're all running on.
Completely. Yeah. And I think, you know, we're coming up with suggestions for how to get people out of that autopilot, but they're not the only suggestions, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's improv or some other way to stop just going through those routines and to question, why am I going through those routines? And are they really working for me? That approach is sort of universally useful as we want to grow as people.
I thought you had a really nuanced, interesting take on values, which you strike as being really, you know, really important for couples to understand their values. And that you write in the book, that, quote, values don't describe how you currently act. They describe what you think is important, even if it might not be obvious based on your actions. And that's important to note, because it doesn't mean that the idea of the value isn't important to understand.
Absolutely.
So what?
And I felt this one very keenly, because I talk about, you know, the importance of caring for your health.
Yeah.
But I could not get an exercise routine to stick for the life of me.
Hmm.
And so I would try in the morning, and then that I'd fall out of that, and then I'd try at lunchtime, and I'd be sweaty in my office, right? So like I tried every different. I would kept trying and trying, and I was like, I have to live this value. But I just can't seem to make it work. And finally, I feel like I found something that's going to stick or has stuck for a while. But it took a long time of me preaching about the importance of health
right.
Without getting regular exercise myself.
I went through a similar thing. And what I was doing was complaining about it at work, to the point that my boss said, I will pay you, or Second City will pay you, for a personal trainer.
Amazing.
And I'm like, you will? And he goes, yes, I actually will, which is a great, you know, this is what work should be. And so I started that 3 months ago, and then I set up my prompt in the morning to always do, to get up. And even if I didn't feel like it, I would do something. And mm-hmm. basically I've been exercising every day for like 3 months, and I feel
amazing.
Yeah. Well, I feel better than I have in ages. So you list out some of the values listed by parents in your research, and they are achievement, adventure, collaboration, courage, generosity, humor, love, responsibility, spirituality. No big surprises. I guess I love the fact that humor's on there, but that doesn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, those are just examples. We have an exercise where if people are getting stuck, we'll have them Google list of values. And I actually do this with my college students too. And if you Google list of values, you can find sheets with 500 different potential values on it. So just the act of reflecting and saying, okay, here's three different ways of saying fun, humor, excitement, you know, which is the one that resonates with me the most? How do I put it into words and articulate what it means to me? That's really important.
So we talk about values and you define that, but that's different than vision, which you also mm-hmm. talk about in this chapter. So how would you define vision in this context?
So the values are sort of describing the present, mm-hmm. sort of what you care about now. And then a vision is a picture of a better future. So we're sort of drawing on the organizational literature on the importance of having a company vision statement,
mm-hmm.
Because it helps people envision, here's where we are, here's where we want to go. And then we can all sort of work together to direct our attention and our energy towards achieving that vision. But if the sales team has one vision and the marketing team has another and the purchasing has another, you're going to really be working at odds with each other. So think about a family now. If you can come up with a shared vision, then you can make choices as an ensemble, I'll use your word, to work towards that. You can all have this sort of shared picture in your mind. And we really push people to be as vivid as possible when they're coming up with that vision.
Yeah, you also write here, and this really struck me, which is, quote, vision can be most useful when crises disrupt everything by reminding mm-hmm. us of our values and how we can draw on them and even adjust to them. And as you know, my family went through this health crisis when we lost our daughter, Nora, to cancer. But what I know about that time period, as difficult as it was mm-hmm. our unit, which is my wife, Ann, and I, and our son, Nick, who's 22 and graduating college this year, and Nora, was that we were able to, like, we had meaning and we were able to operate within this framework as bad as things got. And that I have to take some solace in the fact that we were able to navigate and still laugh together and, you know, sort of live with purpose in a really dark and terrible time.
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging, right? Because when we're in that space of fear.
Yep.
It's really hard to draw on those values and remember the bigger picture. I know when my mom was very sick, I was really operating out of a place of fear, and I didn't have those conversations with her that now I wish I had had.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to beat myself up over what I did when I was, you know, much younger, but I couldn't get to that headspace where I could think about what really mattered in this situation. So I think it's amazing that you were able to, you know, really get there.
Well, so know this, I had the exact same situation. So I gave a talk for this group of folks who work with the elderly and sort of financial institutions. And my talk was all about the fact that I was able to have this experience with Nora, who had been recently diagnosed, and then thinking back to when my mom passed away, where I did not have these conversations. And,
mm-hmm.
and I would literally sort of, because she had dementia, I would block her, you know, when she got something wrong and try to correct her. And again, this is the antithesis of my work, which is all
right.
about saying yes and there's been studies around that you know, you shouldn't be blocking, you should say yes and to those folks. So it was a real lesson, and it's hard, right? It's hard not to beat yourself up about, because these are people you love, but you also, you know, we have to allow ourselves to grow, to make mistakes, to fail forward, and I think this idea of being rooted in values and visions, it doesn't mean that they're not going to change, because stuff does change, but at least it gives you a North Star.
Exactly. Yeah. And I feel, you know, having been through that and, you know, other difficult times in my life, that at least now I have these things articulated and the people around me know what I care about. So we could kind of get through it together.
Can you talk to us about the four-way view? And this is built off of, I think, an earlier book, right?
Yeah. So I've been working with my co-author, Stu Friedman, for over 15 years since I was a grad student. And his sort of company is called Total Leadership, and he teaches it at the Wharton Business School. And the idea was that people can be leaders in all parts of life. And it's really the foundation that, that Parents Who Lead is built upon as well. It's just focusing more specifically on that experience for parents. But the basic idea is that to be a leader, you need to sort of honestly take stock of where you are in the present, right? Leaders can't shy away from reality. Mm-hmm. So the four-way view is just a tool that we offer people to look at how the different parts of their life are interconnected. So rather than looking at it as trade-offs, thinking about how important is my work or my career to me? How satisfied am I with it? How much of my attention am I giving to it? Doing the same for family, for community, which could mean neighbors, religious organizations, clubs, hobbies, etc. And then also the self-domain, that mind, body, spirit, and starting to see how you're currently engaging with those different parts of your life. And then adding in the parenting partner, children, other important people to sort of look at your life as a system of interconnected pieces, as opposed to all of these things where we have to make trade-offs between one or the other. And that goes back to this idea of balance that you mentioned earlier. We don't want to be looking at it from a scarcity perspective of what do I have to give up?
Yeah. And that's hard for some people who work in certain kind of work systems. But increasingly, because we work with so many companies at Second City, we do like 600 dates a year. More and more, we're recognizing that there is an understanding of the importance of family and wellness. And now, you know, men can get leave when they have a kid, which is not the case when I had my children. And this idea that you write in the book, quote, challenges in our family lives don't just magically disappear at work. And we talked to Jane Dutton before and Monica Warline about suffering at work, right? I mean, these are things we do need to pay attention to in our business because they affect productivity, they affect performance. And if we care about our human beings, and I think we should, and we think for the most part people do, it's vital to look at the suffering because, you know, this is tantamount to how they are going to, you know, work for us, you know, not just now, but in the future.
Right. And we don't ever want to sort of lose sight that the changes that we recommend for individuals, we want them to still do their jobs well.
Yeah.
Right. This isn't just about, oh, I'm going to slack off at work so I can be a better parent. Right. It's really finding those win-win solutions, or as we would say with the four-way view, win-win-win-win. But yesterday I was speaking to a group of physicians about this book, and we were talking about the idea that what we find with our participants and in our data is that people tend to devote less of their time and attention to work at the end of our program than at the beginning, but their work performance actually goes up because they are better able to invest their time and attention in the things that really matter because they've clarified expectations. But then I was thinking about, as I was saying it, I was like, oh, but these physicians, You can't necessarily just like work smarter when you're seeing patients, right? That the idea of like, if I'm a person with a ton of autonomy in my career, I can rearrange how I, you know, devote my time and attention, but they have patient hours that they are accountable for. So, you know, to a certain extent, there are constraints that might not be true in other careers.
Yeah, we've been working a lot with that community recently, and you know, we talk a lot because our work that we've done at the University of Chicago is this improv work rooted in evidence. And what we know is that people form quicker bonds when they can share some personal details with each other. But then there's issues in medicine about self-disclosure. And the thing that we're trying to get across to them is like, you don't have to tell someone your deepest, darkest secret. It's like, do you have a dog? You know, can like, right? I mean, and sometimes these little details actually become very salient and rich and allow us to sort of, you know, see each other as people with minds and hearts and souls, and that can make such a difference in patient-physician communication. Because the one thing the physicians will tell you is the patients don't always tell you the truth. In fact, sometimes you got to really dig to get that.
No, that's so interesting. Yeah, I was connecting. I was trying to bond with some new coworkers, some new faculty that we had hired, and I started talking about how excited I was that Trader Joe's was opening in my neighborhood in Hyde Park.
Yep.
And I have now, like, the connection that we formed over Trader Joe's.
Right.
Like, if I see those people, they're like, oh, did you try the new gnocchi? Or, you know,
yeah.
Like, this bonding happened over, you know, I didn't have to reveal, like you said, a deep, dark secret. But now we have this Trader Joe's connection.
All right. So literally, the exercise we taught a bunch of the physicians at Lurie was, my wife created it, called Universal Unique, and I've talked about it on the podcast before. But we have people sort of talk to each other and say how people grocery shop. And then you stop and you do that for a minute, and then you change it to how I grocery shop. And that's when the Trader Joe's stuff comes out. That wouldn't have otherwise, when it becomes very sort of banal and weird and nonspecific. But these little specifics actually contain all this amazing, amazing detail. And now you've got this bond that happened over, you know, frozen gnocchi.
Exactly. And yesterday when we were talking with the physicians, a lot of them came up with, a lot of them settled on the idea of trying grocery delivery. As like, okay, that's, you know, shopping for groceries doesn't fulfill me on a spiritual level.
Right.
That's something that maybe I could let go of because it's more efficient. Whereas maybe cooking with my kids or doing something else related to food is meaningful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Talk to us about workplace acting.
Yeah, so there's been this really interesting body of research about how people have to display emotions in the workplace. And I think we just touch on it in the book. But the idea is, let's say you're a flight attendant,
mm-hmm.
and you've got all these people coming on and being obnoxious and demanding things.
The worst.
You know, some people being nice, but babies crying, et cetera.
Yep.
It's your job to fake like you're happy.
Yes.
And that means that that's going to take a toll. And the research suggests that that takes a toll. And some interesting things happen. First of all, it's a lot harder to fake happy than when you get home because you kind of burnt out on that. I know a lot of people in service work are like, please don't ask me for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Don't talk to me when I get home from work. But also there's a toll of, you know, how do you internally feel, your stress, your mental health. And the research suggests, and to me this was a little counterintuitive, that the people who sort of dig deep and generate the real emotions in order to look happy tend to have less stress and less burnout than the people who just sort of smile but in their head are thinking, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you.
I wonder if there isn't a play, because I totally get this, but I also, there's a guy at Second City mm-hmm. who has to deal with irate customers a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He has this sort of inner calm spirit. He kills them with kindness. It is impossible to you know, get him not to smile back at you or be like, I'm going to try to take care of you. How can I help you? And it comes from such a, I think it's because it's authentic. And that, mm-hmm. like you're saying, sometimes we know those smiles aren't authentic. They're hiding this. I wonder how we get people to that inner peace place where they can just sort of approach the world with that sort of, that calm smile that's real.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, how do you tap into that? And to me, the more intuitive, but a counter to the data, would be that that's actually more exhausting and more draining.
Wow.
But it's not.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think, you know, better off just, like, moving your facial muscles but not doing any actual internal work.
Yeah,
but that's
right.
Just not what the data said. But it's such a, it's such an interesting body of research that a lot of people have spent quite a lot of time thinking about.
So the other thing that the research shows is the importance of social capital, and that's not just at work.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about how social capital might work, like in your community or in the house, as opposed to at work. Because I think everyone understands it from a, like, a networking aspect at work, but it's more than that.
Right. So when we think about social capital in the workplace, we're sort of saying, you know, the help and support that you can draw upon if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're really busy, can you ask someone to cover for you? Will somebody recommend you because they like you? It's sort of your influence that you can, it's your piggy bank of influence and support that you can draw on. And what's interesting about that is that people kind of start to feel a little sleazy about it. Like, oh, I'm just like stacking up all of these favors from people and now they owe me and I'm going to use them. And it kind of feels a little gross. And the same thing in our personal lives. We don't want to just like accrue favors from people. We want to really focus instead on how do we have relationships that are beneficial and mutually rewarding in the present that also then serve as sort of our village when we need help.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not just a short term, you do this, I do that.
Yeah, I have one of those blocks. So I live in the Ravenswood Manor part of the city, and we just have one of those blocks where, you know, the kids all grew up together and a bunch of the families have been there forever. And so we're leaving to go to New York tomorrow to see our son in a play at college, and I forgot to stop the papers. So I just texted my neighbor, Tracy, and I'm like, hey, can you grab the paper on Sunday? And she's like, yeah, like, of course. What else do you need? I'll just keep my eyes on the house. And then vice versa, that is just something you know you can do for all of us, and it's never a tit for tat. It's more of like people are actually happy to help out if they can. That's
exactly so it's not like, well, I fed your cat, so now you owe me.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the mistake that people make. I just got a text from one of my neighbors asking me if my children want to help him move bottles of wine on Sunday. And he's gonna pay them. And at first I was like, I don't think you want my kids moving wine, like they're going to spill it. But I like the idea of like, oh, we're going to help him, and then the next time around he'll help me, but we're also going to hang out this weekend.
Yeah, I don't know. That's great. The other thing I love in this book, because of course in our work in improvisation, it is so much about building resiliency by experimenting over and over and over again. That's how we create scenes in front of audiences. That's how people create characters that are so rich and interesting and funny. And you write in the book, quote, experiments provide a framework for using your imagination, pursuing your curiosity, and exploring how you might lead your lives differently, more fully alive, while serving those who depend on you. That's a lovely, like, concept altogether.
It is, and it's a practice.
Yeah.
Right? I am a self-confessed perfectionist, fear of failure, all of that yucky stuff that makes people not want to try new things. And I've learned over time to sort of fail quickly, fail smart, and to not take it so personally if an experiment that I've come up with doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not easy because, before that it was like, I'm just going to wake up tomorrow and from now on I'll be the kind of person who meal preps on Sundays.
Right.
And then, 3 days later I was like, oh, I'm not that person. And I would feel bad about myself as opposed to thinking, oh, that experiment wasn't the right one.
And it's hard for smart people. I mean, I imagine you did pretty well in school.
I did.
Yes, exactly. And then you're like, but I should have this right. And then when you dig into the science behind it, the idea that like we're actually strengthening the neural pathways by failing towards understanding something, you're like, oh no, this is actually the failure part of it is crucial. And scientists understand this, right? That's what they're doing in labs.
Yep, absolutely. I think there's a book called The Confidence Code, and one of the things it talks about is for women particularly, that achievement in school and that reinforcement that we're getting for the perfectionism, we're not necessarily getting enough opportunities to take risks and to fail. So both of my kids have done improv through school and through in Hyde Park, and they're getting that practice, right? They're playing on sports teams. They're doing performances. They're getting more practice failing, and we're trying to sort of reinforce and say, great failure, try again.
Yeah. I forgot who we interviewed once who said the worst thing you can do after they get an answer right is say, oh, look how smart you are, as if they're not smart when they're struggling with the answer. Okay, in a moment, we're going to ask you for your yes and story, but before that, I want you, there's a word you introduced me to, which was technoference.
Oh, yeah.
Explain, and this is a section which we're talking about, digital media and that sort of thing, and you're not just talking about kids using it and that being a problem.
No, and you know what? A lot of parents are having the conversation about how much media should my kids consume and how much time should they spend on technology, but we're not necessarily looking at ourselves and saying, what is my phone, my computer, my laptop, how is that interfering with my ability to be present and be effective? So technoference is just interference from technology in how you're living your life. So we're asking people to think really deliberately and consciously about the way that technology is impacting them. and I can give you an example, that a realization that I had this week.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when my kids are doing homework, I want to be near them, but they don't necessarily require my full attention. And I was reading books on my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my kids criticized me for just like playing around on social media.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I mean, it's good. It's great that they're paying attention, but they don't know that I'm reading a book.
Right.
And so I switched to my Kindle.
Yeah.
And my Kindle's only for reading a book so that they can see I'm doing something that I tell them is good for them, right? And that I'm, you know, I'm not just looking at other people's lives on social media. I do that too, just more in secret. But I, you know, I wanted to role model for them reading books,
right,
but I couldn't do it with my phone.
Yeah, well, this is a problem. My wife is also a college professor.
Oh, cool.
And she has these moments where she's like, I don't want you taking your notes with your computer because I know you're going to get pinged with social media. I mean, you can't, unless you've turned it all off. And same with taking notes on the phone. She really asks as much as people can do to try to write down their notes. And I know that there's evidence about that being actually a better way to retain information.
Yes, I try to tell my students it's a better way to retain information. I haven't gone as far as to invite them to put their computers away,
yeah,
unless we're having a guest speaker,
mm-hmm,
but I think about it a lot.
Yeah. All right. So the way we end the podcast is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, you groups of people making something out of nothing, you get nowhere by saying no, and you actually don't get that far by saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Well, the most obvious one that comes to me is writing this book. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, for traditional academics, it's all about writing peer-reviewed, very scientific journal articles.
Yeah.
And that's what's rewarded. That's what gets you a promotion. That's what people expect. So to take time and shift my career away from that, you know, type of work that's really rewarded internally, and to say, what about communicating externally? What about using my work to make a difference? Not only was that sort of breaking from what my familiarity was in my career, but also writing a book takes a lot of time and attention.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my daughter said to me one day, you're writing about working parents, so stop working and be a parent.
Oh, God.
And I was like,
oh, no.
Sick burn. But, you know, it's hard. I'm traveling. I'm going to be, you know, traveling for a book launch. I'll be in New York next week and then in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it really pushed me out of my comfort zone in so many different ways. And I'm having just the best time talking about it and sort of riding this experience. But it is certainly not something that I had initially thought would be the path my career would go down.
You know, this is a thing, though, in academia, and I don't think I was as deeply aware until we started our program up at U of C. And you can imagine sort of like Second City matching with like the Center for Decision Research at the Booth School, you know, who,
mm-hmm,
who like basically, if you say, you better say that word, you know, they have no time or place for anything that is not very specific and backed up 100%. And we're, mm-hmm, of course, we're improvisers. We'll say anything. The tension is great, but also what I've recognized over time is there's all this wonderful research that is just stuck in the ivory tower because it is very hard to explain to people or get out in a fashion that they will understand it. And I get that, like, Malcolm Gladwell is such a good storyteller that it ends to sometimes it becomes untrue, which is true. But then there are people like Dan Pink, who I think largely are really good reporters of the literature.
And I think when I started, I thought, I will do the great research, and then someone like Dan Pink or Malcolm Gladwell will,
yeah,
read it and communicate it in a way that's useful to people. And I just couldn't wait around for it to happen.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. Because the distinction between, you know, the idea that we somehow become a different person when we go to work is kind of ridiculous, and it also makes you at a disadvantage, because why would you not bring your entire self and all your history and your knowledge of relationships and your connections and your neighbors, all that stuff counts as being a full human being in the world, which is, I think, what you want to access, what businesses want their people to be.
Absolutely. We have a great story in the book of a family with a seriously ill child. And the mom was really keeping it to herself in the workplace because she didn't want to be seen as somebody who wasn't dedicated to her career. And she wasn't sharing what she was going through. And then in our work with us, she decided, you know what, this is part of who I am. It's important to talk about it. And the first thing that her boss said to her when she brought it up in one of their conversations was that he sees that she's incredibly able to know what's most important and to prioritize, and that he attributes that to all of the things that she's dealing with in her personal life. So he really saw it as an asset.
Yeah, give people a chance to show you their best self, because that's out there. The book is called Parents Who Lead, The Leadership Approach You Need to Parent with Purpose, Fuel Your Career, and Create a Richer Life. Alyssa Westring, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive from adulthood. No one survives.